You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, I'll be joined by my guests, Jane Kinnamont and Phil Clark, to discuss and debate the day's news. In Geneva, diplomats have begun their search for a peaceful solution to Syria's civil war, but there's one small problem. The opposition is nowhere to be found. Then, Brazil is currently battling the Zika virus, which may have arrived on its shores during the 2014 World Cup. So will another sporting event this year, the Olympic Games, spread Zika further around the globe? And a little later on, we'll talk through a stony controversy at Oxford and a crisis in Burundi. All that ahead and more on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Yes, a very warm welcome to Friday evening's Midori House here in London. I'm delighted to welcome my guests today, Jane Kinnamont and Phil Clark. Jane's Senior Research Fellow and Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House. Phil's a reader in international politics at SOAS here in London. Both, of course, regular voices here on Monocle 24. And it's my pleasure to welcome you both back to the programme.
Good evening.
Let's begin in Geneva, where the first Syrian peace talks in 2 years have begun, despite a boycott from the main opposition group. The Kurds, meanwhile, were excluded. Jane, I guess, given who's not there or who's not taking part, would it be a cynic that would say these talks, as other efforts before them, are doomed to failure almost before they start?
The short answer is yes. I mean, it's fairly normal with peace processes that there's a huge controversy about the structure and the participants and the agenda, because no process is entirely neutral. So often refusing to go and having certain demands. In this case, the opposition has been demanding a ceasefire as a confidence building measure before talks. In a way, that is part of a broader process of negotiation. The problem is here that the opposition feels essentially betrayed by their backers. They feel that the West and even Turkey have lost faith in them, that Assad, meanwhile, is fully confident that he has the backing of Iran, especially after its nuclear agreement, and Russia. And they think that they have no hope of actually getting anywhere. The balance of power does seem to be quite firmly with Assad, and the opposition currently feel all they can do is block the process.
Mm. Phil, given that backdrop then, let's say, you know, Phil Clark was suddenly tasked with hosting these discussions. I mean, how would you go about it? Or would you just say, look, this is an impossible task from the outset?
I think the only way to deal with this kind of challenge that Jane's describing is to see these talks as the first of many, and to be really pragmatic about what could come out of this round, given the very important parties that aren't at the table. So, you know, I think there has to be some realism about those limitations and recognise that until these crucial opposition groups are brought into the process, you're not going to have something comprehensive and completely lasting. I think the other thing that this situation reminds us is, of course, that it's not as though these are peace talks happening during a period of ceasefire. The parties are talking about peace in Geneva while they're still fighting back in Syria. They're kind of talking out both sides of their mouth in many ways. And the opposition would say, well, one of the reasons we can't go to Geneva to participate in this process is that we're too busy fighting. We don't have the resources, we don't have the personnel expendable to send off to Geneva. Some of these bigger powers can do that because they can play this on two fronts, but we can't. So that also, I think, injects a certain realism about what could possibly come out of this.
Jane, it's interesting. I guess if we look back to history, maybe there's plenty of very complex, confounding conflicts that have been resolved at the around a negotiating table. It often takes a lot of time. Is this different? You think of what the historically tricky ones. I don't know, the Northern Ireland peace process or Colombia and FARC. You know, literally generations of discussions that go on. Is one of the problems here that there was at least some kind of coherent end game at some of these complex ones that were successful, and at this stage, the Syrian conflict doesn't seem to present a sort of a logical conclusion, no matter what angle you look at it from?
Negotiators often talk about the idea of a hurting stalemate when both sides realise that they're not making progress and that they're losing. Now, in the case of Syria, both sides have lost massively. The Assad regime has lost more than half of its country. The opposition has lost a far greater number of people. But they're not, they don't entirely feel at a stalemate. They still feel that although they might both be losing, one might win relative to the other. And that is partly because of the role of external forces. And this is often a factor that makes conflict much harder to resolve, because the external forces basically are not losing their own people. Iran has lost some people, Hezbollah's been stretched, but essentially they are playing politics with other people's lives in a country that they do not have to live in. And therefore they can think much more about political calculations because they're not bearing the brunt of the cost.
Well, let's talk a bit more about Iran, but we'll come back to Europe. The President, Hassan Rouhani, has been on a whistle-stop whirlwind, well, a bit of a shopping trip almost for his country on the continent. He's been signing the big deals within weeks of international sanctions being lifted. It's interesting, earlier this week we were talking about it seeming, I don't know, slightly strange that Iran was sort of essentially tapping up, you know, France, Italy, a couple of maybe not the most robust global economies to get involved in these big deals. Does that prompt you to ask a question, you know, who actually stands to gain most from those kind of agreements?
Yeah, there might be a slightly tenuous element to a lot of this. I was looking at the major deals that Iran's done in the last couple of days, and the two big ones, I guess, are in France. It's Peugeot and Citroën, the sort of vehicle manufacturers, and then it's Airbus. Two companies that have had a bit of a rocky time in the last few years in terms of failure to deliver on a bunch of other very large contracts. So Iran might be playing a fairly dangerous game there. We'd have to see what that kind of leads to. I guess the other element that's fascinating out of Iran's sort of shopping spree, as you said this week, is how limited the US still is in terms of how it can engage economically with Iran. Mm. That key sanctions have been lifted, but key US sanctions are still in place. Mm. And that may put some pressure on the US government when big business in the state says, we want a piece of the pie as well. Why are we seeing our European competitors get a head start on us? We may see some political shift because of economic pressure.
James, it's interesting with Iran. You know, clearly people talk about this extraordinary, you know, economic powerhouse that's been forcibly dormant for a spell or whatever. What are the limits, do you think, of where Iran's economic potential might take it? I don't know, diplomatically, if we look at the fractured regional picture, which we've already been talking about, how far could it influence that positively in the short term, I guess?
If Iran is able to actually have sanctions, the lifting of sanctions be sustained, if the nuclear deal is sustained, then Iran could potentially, maybe 10 years down the line, be the biggest economy in the Middle East. It has many more people than Saudi Arabia, slightly fewer people than Egypt, but a very diversified economy, very educated population, and one, as you say, that's been kept kind of artificially dormant because of the sanctions. The potential is really huge. Right now, in fact, it may be partly less direct political risk, apart from the US companies and their sanctions, as the business environment. It's not exactly a country that's been set up to encourage foreign investment in every sector. The Revolutionary Guards have monopolies in a lot of areas. The banking sector is really underdeveloped. So a lot of companies are kind of trying to work out that they want to have the first mover advantage. You're getting in there early, but currently it is still very difficult, very uncertain. You worry about corruption, all of these things. Also, they are not able to do the kind of business that they should be able to do with their neighbours because of the regional politics. I flew in from Saudi Arabia this morning. Basically, almost every meeting that you have with anyone in Saudi Arabia, if you're a Westerner, involves being harangued at some length for naivety, stupidity, conspiracy or whatever. Because the West no longer wants Iran to be an enemy, the Saudis can see its economic potential and they're worried that it won't just be a non-enemy, it will replace them.
Well, and I guess, Phil, that's interesting. Coming back to Europe again, you look at these big French companies, the Italian corporations that have signed deals and state institutions as well. Do you think there will be a reticence, maybe understandable, from some of those countries where people say, well, yeah, hang on, what is the picture in corruption? Are state funds safe? What's the record of Iran on human rights, for example, that's often talked about? Or do you think that ultimately, you know, those euro signs will overwhelm any reservations that people have?
I think at the moment the euro signs are going to win out. This might have been a very different conversation 5-10 years ago when Europe wasn't in the sort of perilous economic state that it is at the moment. Some of these French companies and Italian companies we've been talking about may not have the luxury of being so choosy about putting ethics at the forefront and may just have to take the deals that are there, which means that those companies and these European states that are also looking to invest in Iran are going to be subjecting themselves to enormous risk at a time when they're already on very fragile ground. So it's a very difficult economic time for Europe in that sense, and maybe a hope that Iran can be some sort of savior.
I mean, Jenny, one thing that struck me is quite interesting, some of the rhetoric from Rouhani. You know, he sort of had a sort of thinly veiled swipe at Europe broadly, talking about the sort of complaints that come from the continent about refugee movement, saying, you know, well, Iran's dealt with this from Afghanistan or from wherever for decades, and we just got on with it. Do you think we should expect to see a bit more, almost, I don't know if it's a playful tone, but a bit more of that kind of rhetoric, a bit of being slightly more emboldened, given the sort of the economic opening up that we've seen?
Absolutely. Part of it is aimed at domestic politics. Iran has got parliamentary elections coming up in February, also elections for the Assembly of Experts, which is the council that selects the supreme leader. And as always happens with the parliamentary elections, anyone who seems very liberal or reformist has been ruled out of their candidacy. So there is a bit of posturing going on. There are many people that think Rouhani has gone too far, kind of embracing the West, being photographed, you know, sort of cozying up to Kerry, etc. So it's useful for him to have the occasional easy swipe at the Europeans and the Americans.
Let's move on. We cross to Brazil now, where it's believed more than 1.5 million people have contracted the Zika virus, a disease researchers believe could have spread to the country during 2014's Football World Cup. It's thought Zika spread to more than 20 countries in the Western Hemisphere since then. Phil, we've got, what, 500,000 people or more expected to travel to Brazil, from quite literally almost all points of the globe for the Olympics this year. Do you understand the concern that a number of, you know, infectious disease specialists and the like have, that this could make a really quite terrible situation significantly worse yet?
This must be the most embattled Olympics in history. The Brazilian government can't catch a break at the moment. They've had, you know, controversies over street protests and the cost of these Olympics, controversies over their policing strategies in big urban areas. It's a government that has its own massive corruption scandals with Petrobras and other elements in the lead up to the Olympics. And then it gets the Zika virus sort of on top of that. So there must be officials within Brazil now wondering whether it was worth taking this event on. And then the danger is that Brazil will then potentially be blamed if there is a sort of global spread of Zika as a result of the Olympics. They'll be blamed for having very poor health infrastructure, that their kind of screening of people coming into the country hasn't been effective enough. So this could be a political disaster for the Brazilian government.
Jane, a lot of people, when these sorts of problems begin to seemingly sweep through, you know, countries, regions, and then the global threat it becomes apparent, they naturally look at responses. You know, they look to, you know, governments, they look to nation states. Where should people be looking? Is this a sort of thing, the gravity of it is so significant that the response should be from, you know, supranational bodies, international organizations? Are they doing enough? Should they be at least seen to be doing more?
Well, it's one of these complex problems that can't be dealt with simply by individual governments because it's fundamentally cross-border. And we saw the WHO wrong-footed by Ebola. We saw Médecins Sans Frontières moving more quickly. But they have also said very clearly it's not an NGO that should be relied upon to deal with things. It has to be something that's led by governments or intra-governmental organisations. It is worth stressing, though, the WHO has taken this virus extremely seriously because they're worried about being wrong-footed again. It's not the same kind of epidemic as Ebola. It seems to come from mosquitoes. It's not spread person to person. It's not the same type of situation where health workers that are working there are all going to suddenly get caught up in this. So there also needs to be a little bit of caution. You don't necessarily need to panic about one thing because of what happened with the last thing.
Sure. Well, I guess one criticism levelled at the WHO and some of those others you've mentioned is that they don't have the specific kind of, you know, rapid response capabilities, I guess, that people would imagine They might. I mean, is that a fair point?
They'd also been suffering from massive budget cuts before the Ebola crisis. And, you know, in a time of austerity in many Western countries, you see the pressure on foreign aid in many European countries. Then preparedness for kind of preventing and preparing for health emergencies just isn't something that people will necessarily prioritise or certainly not vote for.
And Phil, I guess it's interesting, you know, we talk a little bit about the necessity for governments and supranational organisations to get involved. Is there a problem because sovereignty can be a concern here? Often governments would need to cede some control, whether that's just giving information, whether it's literally leaving the space for the policies to be set elsewhere by the UN or by others. I mean, is it understandable in some respects that they are reluctant to consider doing that?
Absolutely. I think it puts a big challenge on issues of transparency in particular. And that's going to be really interesting to watch with Brazil in the context of the Olympics. How transparent are they with the extent of the Zika virus and its spread in the country? How transparent will they be about the possibility that it may spread across borders at a time, again, when they're already embattled on all of these fronts, as we've already mentioned? I think the other thing that factors into Zika, which we didn't see with Ebola, is, of course, this is happening on the U.S. doorstep. Mm-hmm. So we perhaps have seen a slightly more rapid response, as limited as it still is in the Zika case, because of this concern that it could start to affect a big Western mm-hmm. power. And we didn't see that in Ebola. I think there still was a sense, this is in Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea. It's out of sight, out of mind for most of the big Northern Hemisphere governments. So Zika poses a different geopolitical reality in that regard.
Certainly sobering, and we'll chart that with some interest and trepidation. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. I'll be back with Phil Clark and Jane Kinnamont after this.
Join Monocle Films at the Murano Wine Festival, where our roving specialist Marcus Hippie discovers a new generation of South Tyrolean vintners on the high altitude, sunny slopes of northern Italy.
The last 30 years have been great for South Tyrolean wines, and there is no reason to think that this evolution will end here. With the excitement and passion that now prevails in the region, it is time for South Tyrol to go from the hidden gem of Italian wine to a real jewel in the global crown.
Start the new year with new discoveries. Check out our South Tyrolean wine special in the film section of monocle.com.
On the menu, we explore the delicious, diverse, and eminently digestible world of food, drink, and hospitality every week. Join me, Marcus Hippi, as I meet everyone from the bakers to the makers who are redefining the culinary landscape.
Many people think that it might be gamey somehow because these are hairy animals that have horns, but it's quite the opposite. I think the milk has a cleaner, sweeter flavor than cow milk.
We'll also head to Kenji's kitchen for a roundup of restaurant reviews, interviews with top chefs, and trade secrets with our Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall, in Tokyo and beyond.
The beer market has been changing rapidly for some time now. It seems like almost every month, a new pub that specializes in craft beer is opening.
All that and even a dinner party soundtrack recommendation, so your ears are catered for as well as your belly. A healthy serving of the finest free-range fare to sate your radio appetite each week. That's the menu on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, still with me, Phil Clark from SOAS and Jane Kinnamont from Chatham House. To The Hague now for our next story. At the International Criminal Court, the ex-president of the Ivory Coast, Laurent Gbagbo, has been accused of overseeing what's been called unspeakable violence after losing an election in early 2011. Around 3,000 people were killed in the country during 4 months of conflict. Gbagbo's pleaded not guilty to all charges. At the same time, the ICC's launched an investigation into possible war crimes committed during the 2008 war between Georgia and Russia. So the court's keeping busy. But of course, the ICC's often been criticised as being rather selective with how it prosecutes world leaders. So has that changed at all? Phil, what do you mean? I mean, I guess you'd probably agree that some of the criticism is perhaps warranted. Is there an inconsistency in approach before we talk about the specifics of Gbagbo from the ICC?
Yeah, undoubtedly. I'm writing a book on the ICC in Africa at the moment, and in fact, had just written a chapter about why it was almost guaranteed that the court wouldn't move out of Africa for the next sort of 10 years or so, and then the news this week requires a rewrite of that chapter. No, I think this was a huge strategic mistake by the court to spend its first 14 years in one continent, and a continent with a fraught colonial history. Where one of the very easy criticisms thrown at the ICC was that it was a neo-colonial institution, a Europe-based court that was intervening in places it didn't know very much about and messing with political dynamics on the ground. So I think just from the perspective of the ICC legitimizing itself as a global institution, it needed to be seen to be global from day one, and this overemphasis on Africa has been a huge mistake.
So, Jen, I guess if that's kind of hamstrung the ICC to a degree from the outset, what about the international laws, the frameworks that exist that it's trying to operate within? Are they actually fit for purpose as well, or was its task, although it maybe didn't go about it in the right way from the beginning, was its task in itself too difficult from the start?
Well, there is a huge problem with international law that there isn't an international executive to enforce it apart from perhaps the UN Security Council, and obviously the big superpowers of the world have veto power there. So again, with the ICC, it's taken a huge leap, really, by going as far as saying that heads of state can be indicted. But of course, the US is not a signatory to it. Even if the US was a signatory, it's pretty unlikely in practice that you would see an American head of state indicted. But it shows you a reason for the frustration of many developing countries. And that has backfired, because we've seen, for instance, Omar Bashir of Sudan actually encountering a lot of solidarity among other African countries and being able to travel. Because they feel that he's being unfairly treated, despite plenty of evidence that, you know, terrible war crimes were committed by his forces.
So, Phil, going back to that big picture then, with the likes of, it's a good example that Jane raises, Omar Bashir, you know, the US was quite quick to welcome that, to encourage that sort of prosecution, but not a signatory. So with the suggestions of hypocrisy from some of the key global powers, plus the mistaken or misguided approach over the first 14 years, you know, what next for the ICC? Can it survive? Can it function? Can they turn things around? What do you think?
It's a court that I think will rumble on despite all of these massive problems, if only because there are big powers that back it. And most of the big European states support the ICC. It gets a lot of its funding from Japan. I think for those reasons, it will rumble on. And the international criminal legal community is a powerful and well-resourced one. And they see the ICC as the institution that they were fighting and dreaming of for decades. So I think for those reasons, it'll last. But whether it has any teeth, I think, is a completely different question. Mm-hmm. And it's going really out on a limb in taking on a case like Russia and Georgia. What we've seen up until now is that the ICC hasn't worked out how to deal with state power. So it tends to get manipulated by states. We've seen this in Kenya, where the Kenyan government has run rings around the court. We've seen it in places like Uganda and Congo, where those governments have actually used the ICC against their political opponents. So the ICC hasn't been very politically savvy. And now I think it's dealing with even more powerful states. It's taking on Russia with its place on the Security Council, its very powerful apparatus on the ground. I think the big challenge the court will find in Russia and Georgia is, can it in fact even run effective investigations? Can it get its personnel into these countries? Can it gather evidence? Can it build credible cases? So symbolically, it's important that the court has moved out of Africa. But I think in terms of the practicalities of investigations and prosecutions, it's going to find Russia and Georgia perhaps a too big a task.
Indeed. Well, let's turn next to Burundi, a country in some turmoil since April, ever since the president, Pierre Nkurunziza, announced plans to run for a third term. Protests followed, along with clampdowns on the press. Foreign journalists have been expelled. Police have recently arrested a British and French journalist in the capital during a sweep for rebels. Meanwhile, evidence has emerged showing possible mass graves. Phil, I know this is sort of your area of expertise, or within it. Give us a quick sort of overview of this crisis. Would we be wrong to look at this and see, once again, you know, headlines in the West about, you know, a leader who it wants to run for, you know, more terms than he should, et cetera, et cetera?
Or is it classically, again, far more complex than just a basic power struggle?
I think it is a little more complex, but the trigger for the latest violence has been President Nkurunziza wanting to change the constitution to run for a third term. And he basically forced that change through the legal system a few months ago. But I think the bigger picture is that his has been a profoundly unpopular government from day one. It's been incredibly corrupt. We've seen the underdevelopment of most areas of Burundi while a small elite in the capital, Bujumbura, have enriched themselves. So the countryside has been furious about this government for a long time. And the third term issue really is just the latest sort of misstep by this government. But I think at the moment, Burundi really still is on the precipice of what could be a really horrific period of violence. It's been bad enough in the last year. 600 or 700 people have been killed. Something now like 240,000 Burundians have been displaced into the neighbouring country. So that's a humanitarian disaster in and of itself. But what could be really scary in the next few months is if the Burundian army continues to fragment. There are signs of that at the moment. It hasn't entirely happened. But if the army breaks apart, we could see military factions fighting each other. The civilian toll will grow exponentially. And I think that's the real concern. It could get infinitely worse in the next few months.
Jane, just very briefly on this. Is it yet another one of these examples that strikes you where we don't really see this story being told? We don't hear about the threat, the sort of tinderbox that this could become. Where does the fault of that lie? Is it, again, Western selective Western media just simply seemingly turning a blind eye often to, you know, a compelling story about something that could be absolutely catastrophic?
It's a big issue for Africa in general. Burundi's obviously in a region that has suffered protracted instability, first with the violence in Rwanda and then the prolonged violence in the DRC, which we almost never see in Western media. And there's all sorts of reasons, less familiarity with some of these countries, the expense and difficulty of getting pictures out of some of these countries. They are very much underreported.
Mm. Well, let's end perhaps by touching on it picks up on a couple of themes we've mentioned about sort of post-colonialism and some of these rather awkward dynamics, and it relates to Cecil Rhodes. There's a smouldering row I'm sure many of our listeners are already familiar with over Oriel College's Cecil Rhodes statue in Oxford. It's staying, Phil, it seems now. What's going on? You're a sort of an erstwhile Oxford man. You know about these sorts of dynamics. What on earth is this latest development?
Yeah, and I got a Rhodes scholarship as well. I should probably divulge at the outset. So this is a particularly personal story. But no, I mean I think the statue's become a real it's probably a terrible metaphor, but a lightning rod for so many other perhaps more profound issues. And my own personal sense is that it's useful to keep these statues because they do generate these sorts of very important debates. And let's face it, an old institution like Oxford has not dealt with the legacies of Rhodes and a lot of its own lack of transformation. And it's these protests around the statue that have finally got those issues on the agenda. And we are now seeing Oxford have to shift in particular ways. One example of this is the Rhodes chair of race relations, one of the most important positions in terms of the study of history in Oxford, recently shortlisted only black African candidates. This is in a university where there are only 4 permanent black staff members. So to have an entire shortlist of black African academics, I think shows that the university is finally waking up to just how deep in the past it is and how much transformation is required. So this protest, even though I don't think the statue should come down, I think the protest has been extremely important.
James, it's interesting, isn't it? You think about this Rhodes statue outside the University of Cape Town, for example, which was taken down, and it seemed a more compelling and sort of logical, rational case almost for that. I just wonder, is there a bit of a danger? There's clearly positives, this sort of discourse that Phil's describing. But, you know, if you follow that logic and remove this statue, you'd be removing what? How many of London statues? Half, possibly.
Well, this is true. You look at the statue of Oliver Cromwell outside Parliament, who was a great pioneer of parliamentary democracy, but also to the Irish, you know, a tyrant and a butcher, someone who should be up before the ICC. So, you know, the entire history is complex, and those who have defended the statues have been saying if we were removing things like this, we would be whitewashing history. I don't think it's quite that simple, because a statue is something that is by nature glorifying and celebratory. But I would be more concerned about things like how much is Oxford's curriculum or syllabus actually being updated. Now, I studied there quite some time ago, so my knowledge isn't that up to date, but certainly studying politics at Oxford is much more traditional than it is if you're studying, say, at Phil's University. You learn very little in terms of critiques of empire, histories of other parts of the world. Those are bigger issues.
They are big issues indeed, and they've brought us to the end of today's Midori House. It's all we have time for. Thanks very much to Jane Kinnamont from Chatham House and Phil Clark from SOAS. Thank you both. Thanks to our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Yasmin Omar, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. We're back on Monday. Goodbye.